This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. Did you know that olive oil is at its peak of flavor and nutrition right after it's fresh pressed at harvest time? That's why my favorite olive oil is delivered to me direct from the latest harvest, thanks to the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. And now you can try a bottle yourself, normally $39, for just $1, with no obligation to buy anything else. Visit myfavoriteoliveoil.com. In my case, it truly is. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla. And my, aren't we getting into the fall?
October.
I know. Incredible. The Halloween decorations are up already in the stores. Yeah, the pumpkins.
Yeah.
Somebody was in the market today with a kid and they said, do you have pumpkins yet? I said, no, we don't have pumpkins. They're coming next week. So, okay, we're moving right along through the seasons.
Yep.
And lo and behold, wasn't it just last week that they told us to reduce our meat intake?
Yes, that was the plant-based diet movement.
That was the EAT report, the EAT report.
Oh, yes.
Which stated that we should, for two reasons, eat less red meat. First of all, that it's carcinogenic and causes heart disease. Mm. And by the way, you know, you'll be saving the planet, you know, in so doing. And so the EAT Lancet report, big, big report, made a splash. My headline on Facebook today is, eat this, Lancet. And it's a report from an article in the Annals of Internal Medicine.
Mm-hmm.
New York Times headlines it this way, eat less red meat, scientists said. Now some believe that was bad advice.
Okay.
Subtitle, The evidence is too weak to justify telling individuals to eat less beef and pork. And so this is an enormous food fight.
Mm-hmm.
And, I was at my high school reunion, 50th high school reunion a couple of weeks ago.
Uh-huh.
And, one of my ground rules was I said, let's not have any discussions about politics, religion, or diet.
Yeah.
And then we'll all
They're
get along.
They're explosive.
We'll all get along. Fine. You know, 50 years later, no matter what our differences are, we're coming together. We're going to have some fun. So, but there's a real It is a vicious controversy. It has gotten to the point where the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, in the wake of this report in the Lancet, in the Annals of Internal Medicine, the pro-meat report that exonerates meat, they have filed a lawsuit so that there's to get an injunction to prevent the publication of this information.
Oh my.
Right?
My goodness.
That's pretty weird.
Yeah.
Is that now we're going to settle scientific arguments in the courtroom, right? So that we're going to prevent because it's thought to be a message that could kill countless millions of people and bring about planetary destruction if we exonerate meat.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
They've weaponized it.
Yes. So, all that they're saying in the Annals of Internal Medicine, it's a very, so what they're saying in this article is that the headline is Unprocessed Red Meat and Processed Meat Consumption, Dietary Guideline Recommendations from the Nutritional Recommendations Consortium. They're saying simply that dietary guideline recommendations require consideration of the certainty in the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
The magnitude of potential benefits and harms, and explicit consideration of people's values and preferences.
Mm-hmm.
A set of recommendations on red meat and processed meat consumption was developed on the basis of systematic reviews that considered all of these issues.
Yeah.
And what they're saying is that the evidence against red meat is not strong enough.
It's not. It's weak.
It's very
at best.
Weak. They're saying that they looked at all the studies that suggest that meat contributes to cancer or meat contributes to heart disease, and
most of them are observational.
Yeah.
And when you do observational studies,
it's not cause and effect.
It's really hard to separate out. So these days, we've kind of flipped the script, because in the old days, it used to be wealthy people who ate meat and poor people couldn't afford meat. Now it's the opposite. It's wealthy right. people are vegans, or they're eating arugula,
right.
you know, and poor people are just getting, like, what's for dinner? Pot roast,
yeah.
you know, or like bologna. Yeah, we got bologna and cheese sandwiches.
Right.
You know?
$1 meal.
Right.
At McDonald's.
Yeah. So,
or something.
So maybe
yeah.
poor people are less likely to have superb health behaviors.
Yeah.
We know that you can actually predict longevity based on your zip code.
Yes.
Economic stress
Food
shortens
deserts.
Your life.
Yeah.
Just the economic stress of, like, trying to make it from day to day.
Yeah.
There's more pollution. You know, if you mm-hmm. live in, you know, beautiful Monterey, California, or, you mm-hmm. know, high in a mesa in Santa Fe, you're above the pollution.
Yeah. But not when you're in the inner city.
Yeah.
And in a food desert.
Right.
And you can't go out certain times of night.
Right.
And all of that is a stress.
Violence, alcohol, smoking,
yeah.
passive smoking, blah, blah, blah. You know, mm-hmm. so there's so many factors that confound these studies that,
social support.
So that one expert, he's, John Ioannidis, and he's the guy who wrote,
yeah.
you know, the headline was Study of Study Shows Most Studies Wrong.
Yeah.
You know, and he's a guy, he's a statistician.
That's a watershed article.
Yeah, he's a statistician, and what he's saying is, he called for a cessation of epidemiological studies and observational studies in nutrition. He says they're worthless.
Mm.
They just cannot be accomplished without distortion or bias.
Even Dr. Jeffrey Bland has said, what do epidemiological studies show us? Nothing. Really nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
I've heard him say it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So we've got a problem there.
Yeah.
So the other, as to the argument of, you know, will it save the planet? Well, that's a different argument. And I don't think that argument should be hooked up
to
the argument about what the ideal human diet should
be. Right, right.
Yes, we should practice sustainable agriculture. Yes, we should reduce pollution.
Mm-hmm.
No, we should not commit horrible, imposed cruelty on animals.
Mm-hmm.
Those are different considerations. But when it comes to the science of what people should eat to sustain human health, we shouldn't say, okay, well, you know, maybe meat really isn't so bad, but we have to save the planet, so we should all become vegetarians.
Mm.
As, you know,
that would be at the expense of our health, in my opinion.
Potentially,
yeah.
Because what do people substitute when they get off of meat?
Carbs.
Often starch.
Carbs. Starch, grains.
Yeah.
More. That means
chips.
Yeah.
Chips,
all of
Ahoy.
That stuff.
Yeah.
And you're exposing yourself to more pesticide, herbicide. You're not saying no to Monsanto. And, you know, these, the observational studies also, they're still not making a distinction between all meat eaters are eating fast food. All meat eaters are having their beer and their cigarettes and their fries and their shake along with their burger, their bacon cheeseburger or whatever. So they're not making any distinction between that and the arugula eater with the grass-fed ribeye.
So another problem, too, is conflicts of interest.
Yes.
Is that many of the researchers, they carry their own personal biases with them.
Yeah.
I have a personal bias. You have a personal bias.
Yeah.
But there are researchers who not only have personal biases, but they also have conflicts of interest because they mm-hmm. consult with companies that are trying to make mm-hmm. things like the Impossible Burger.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're betting on that horse.
Yeah.
You know. So, you know, we got some problems.
We
do. Some problems with the research. And this is going to roil the waters more, but I'm glad for it, because it was time that a responsible group of researchers pushed back against what seemed to be like this monolithic recommendation. Okay, this exalted committee in The Lancet, the world's leading medical journal, has now decreed once and for all time that we should reduce our animal protein consumption.
That will also help the planet on other levels if we're told not to have babies anymore, Dr. Hoffman. Well, if you're going to eat a Kellogg's cornflake diet, what's going to happen to your libido? Right? And so forth. And so it snowballs into even more and more and more of, I don't know.
And reductio ad absurdum, I think.
Right.
Okay, so let's get to questions. Radioprogram@AOL.com is the place for questions. We also have, in part two, we'll talk about a nice article on fish oil supplements that hit the news today. But let's get to questions.
Okay, we have an email from Dorothy. Is there any pre-testing for ALS or supplements to include that may be helpful? My father died many years ago from ALS. Now that I'm 70, I'm concerned since I seem to be having some muscle pain in my right arm several weeks.
How old is the person?
She's 70.
She's 70 and she has muscle pain in her right arm.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome to the world of post-70. You know, I'm about to celebrate my 67th birthday, and you know, every morning I do an assessment.
Uh-huh.
You know, I get out of bed slowly, and it's like, how am I doing? You know, is there something that's hurting?
Uh-huh.
And since I exercise, usually there is.
So
that is, first of all, this is the relative is what, a cousin?
Father died many years ago from ALS.
Father died. So is ALS,
so she's concerned.
Is ALS hereditary? Yes, it probably is partially hereditary, but only very partially hereditary, just like Alzheimer's is partially hereditary.
Mm-hmm.
And heart disease is partially hereditary, and cancer is partially hereditary. Through genetic testing, we may be able to hone in on a gene, certainly not probably a gene, but a set of genes that are predisposing for ALS. We probably won't find that there is the ALS gene, but they're hot on the trail of genetic prediction of these diseases.
Yeah.
That's not ready for prime time. We're doing some genetic work right now, which speaks to the issue of whether the brain is susceptible to neurodegenerative disorders.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, what's meaningful for Alzheimer's or Parkinson's may not be meaningful for ALS.
They're,
you know, different parts of the brain, different processes may be involved. So when it comes to ALS prevention, it appears that there are some subtypes of ALS. Some of the subtypes of ALS may be more amenable to antioxidant strategies and things like glutathione, sulforaphane.
For detox.
Right.
That it has to do with toxins more than being exposed to any kind of pesticides.
There's also the theory that toxic algae may be the cause of certain types of ALS.
Mm.
That's a controversial theory. There was an article about it in Forbes magazine recently. They proposed serine as the antidote to that.
Yeah, L-serine.
But serine would only work if it were to reverse that subtype of Alzheimer's or ALS.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think if you encounter someone who says they have a cure for ALS, you should do a 180 and run in the opposite direction. Even in the field of integrative medicine. And you know, I think that anybody who makes that claim is unethical and untruthful.
Mm-hmm.
We can support patients with ALS. I've treated patients with ALS.
Yes.
I think we've kept them healthier and more functional for longer. But there's not, in my mind, a surefire strategy.
Yeah. So potent antioxidants, glutathione boosters like N-acetylcysteine, vitamin D.
Avoidance of neuroexcitatory things like MSG.
Oh, MSG is a big one.
You know, that's the theory that...
aspartame is NutraSweet, ladies and gentlemen. That diet soda that you're after, for example, is still sweetened with aspartame.
Right. So that these may have effects where they, in effect, sort of burn out certain parts of the brain with hyper-excitatory stimuli. Mm-hmm.
You need ample amounts of magnesium, B vitamins, amino acids. So making sure you have ample protein in your diet. There's phase one and phase two, detoxification of the liver. You want to make sure both phases are working well.
And for if this were a person coming in to see me and really wanted to do a deep dive on it, I would say, you know, let's do some genetic testing to see if you have certain weak pathways, not necessarily pathways that say, oh, you are going to definitely get ALS,
but
what are your vulnerabilities?
What are the vulnerabilities that can be helped?
It might translate to ALS. It might translate to earlier cognitive decline. It might translate to a movement disorder like Parkinson's. It doesn't.
Mm.
These
Another toxin-mediated condition.
These pathways
possibly
may be common pathways in many neurodegenerative disorders. Mm-hmm. It's just a question of which part of the brain or which process will it hit first.
Yeah. Interesting stuff. So, Dorothy, take your antioxidants, boost your glutathione.
But above all, don't worry, because yeah. I think there's a pain in the arm, and a father with ALS does not a case of pre-ALS make.
Yeah. Yeah. So, don't fear so much. Do get checked out. Dorothy, thank you for your email.
Yeah, a neurologist can perform the check if you're concerned.
Yeah. We have an email. We have a question here. Please discuss the pros and cons of magnesium. The only con I can think of, Dr. Hoffman, you take enough magnesium, you might get diarrhea.
Hey, but that could be a plus.
But that could be a plus if you're constipated, right?
Right.
Exactly.
Well, okay, so, I mean, to be precise,
yeah,
we have some patients who are on dialysis or they have very high creatinine because of renal failure, and they have to explain what happens there. Yeah.
What happens, you want to make sure that you're not giving that person with chronic chronic kidney disease or advanced renal failure magnesium, because the kidneys are going to have a hard time.
Now, would that happen when somebody has a creatinine of like 1.4?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Already at that point?
Already at that point, if it's on the way or on the trend moving towards that, we want to be careful with magnesium.
Okay, and maybe measure levels.
We would measure levels. You don't want to give them 1,200 milligrams of magnesium. Maybe 200 is okay. But to each is unique.
Right.
We have to look at each situation.
And I think the biggest concern about magnesium is that it has some cardiac effects, beneficial cardiac effects.
Yeah.
But it can also cause changes in the ST interval of the electrocardiogram, and it's like has to do with electrical conduction and mm-hmm. Heart rate. So they can cause, frankly, very high levels of magnesium could cause heart block.
Right.
Technically.
Well, eat too many apples and you'll get a stomach ache. One apple may keep the doctor away, but eat a bucket full and you're going to have a stomach ache.
So we're concentrating on the downsides, because the upsides are so
many.
Voluminous. And you're going to write an article on that?
Oh, yeah.
This person doesn't want to hear us talk about it anyway. They want an article.
They want an article. So I'm going to do an article.
Okay.
Yeah.
To each his own. Some people like the podcast format. Some people say, I can't, it hurts my ears.
Somebody said, please write about it.
I want to read an article. Okay. So they're old school.
Oh, gosh. So thank you for that. You could read about it more in the Intelligent Medicine newsletter. Should be coming out this week.
Okay.
Or next week.
As every week.
Next week.
Well, that article
exactly.
coming out, yeah.
Exactly.
Boy, this is not a week we put in a lot of effort into that. 52 weeks a year content?
52 weeks
a year.
That's
a lot of content.
Yeah.
I mean, some people put out a newsletter like every month or something like that, or every quarterly.
Mm-hmm.
We're cranking one out
every week, and it's free, ladies and gentlemen. You can unsubscribe also at any time.
Or you could not read it. But don't, it's like nobody's putting a gun to your head.
Right. We have an email from Bob. Hi, Dr. H and Layla. I was recently diagnosed with Barrett's esophagus. I'm a 71-year-old male in good health otherwise. I'm a BRCA2 positive. That's a male.
Okay, why is that important?
He's got that gene.
Gene, I don't know if that's really even associated with esophageal cancer risk. It's a breast cancer gene.
Yes.
And so it does call for a little more, men have about 1% of all the breast cancer, which is very low, but, considering a ball of breast cancer that's there, there's quite a few thousand men who get breast cancer.
Right. So he says, I'm a BRCA2 positive and an 18-year survivor of BRCA and a 10-month survivor of a sebaceous gland adenoma.
I guess he had breast cancer.
Yeah.
Okay.
18 years ago.
Oh, wow.
My younger brother died at 43 of a rare and aggressive form of esophageal cancer after being diagnosed with Barrett's.
Okay. So there's something more going on with that family than just a BRCA2.
And his brother was also BRCA2 positive.
Okay, so BRCA2, I don't think, determines esophageal cancer risk.
Yeah.
I think there's some cancer vulnerability in that family that maybe multi-gene variations that predispose to less good cancer surveillance. We all have cancer surveillance mechanisms. Cancer events may occur spontaneously in the body. The body edits that, fixes it, puts it to rest. But when those defenses fail, cancer can emerge.
Yeah. Yeah. All fixing and repairing that DNA sequencing.
Yeah.
That is so important. And it's very important that you don't have the toxic overload so that your body machinery and repair processes can do that effectively. A 12-hour fast every night is critical to making sure that your body has the time not just to rest.
It's a cleanup.
It's a cleanup, a house cleaning and repair. Mm-hmm. So it's all that and the handyman to fix those problems. And you need a full 12 hours minimum.
Well, okay. So let's summarize.
Yeah.
This guy has had breast cancer. He has Barrett's esophagus, which is somewhat
And he's 71.
And he's 71. And he has a brother who died of esophageal cancer.
Yeah, at 43.
Wow.
Which is
so he
probably
needs,
on his
like
mind.
Like a lot of anti-cancer nutrients. So we can think of some of them. They're
sulforaphanes.
Sulforaphane. DIM, all these
AHCC.
Are broccoli sprout, HCC, which is, you know, a advanced hexoscorylated compound.
Mm-hmm.
He needs adequate vitamin D. He might need fish oil as a natural anti-inflammatory. Curcumin is also good. Green tea is also
green
good. Green tea, especially against esophageal cancer.
Yes.
Drink green tea and or take supplements of green tea.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a few.
Acetylglucosamine.
Tocotrienols are now emerging. Delta tocotrienols are now emerging.
Vitamin C, definitely.
Certainly vitamin C.
Is very good anti-cancer.
Here's a controversial one. I think for cancer prevention, folate is very good. If you have active cancer, got to be a little careful with folate. So it's one of those things that is duality. I wouldn't give it to someone who has active cancer, but maybe. And I've given it to Barrett's esophagus patients successfully. Selenium, maybe.
Yeah. About 150, 200 micrograms a day. If you eat a few Brazil nuts a day, you're getting a nice amount of selenium as well.
Right.
Yeah.
As to diet,
you should be on a GERD type diet. So you want to make, we've seen cases where Barrett's has regressed.
Many
has
cases.
Has gotten better, yeah.
Many cases.
Has gotten better.
Many cases.
You want your esophagus to have a
kid.
Exactly.
You've had patients where they've said, they're ecstatic. They come in, they said, for my last checkup, they couldn't find any.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a case where a precancer can regress and not progress.
Right. That has happened. And we've seen that happen. And you want to be on a GERD-type diet. You want to take things also like L-glutamine, which helps with the repair of the lining.
Glutamine could be helpful.
Yes, of the esophagus. And again, in the case of in the setting of an already existing cancer, we also are careful with glutamine.
Right. Glutamine has a duality too.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. You don't want to have too much, but having some, it's the preferred form of feeding for the intestinal mucosa. So it's helpful. All right, Bob. We hope that helps you out. You should visit a nutritionist to give you a proper GERD diet to help you with that.
Well, I got to say, we have reached the time limit for part one.
Wow.
But in addition to our consideration of a new surprising article on the cardiovascular benefits of fish oil, what are we going to take up? What's our next question?
Oh, I have relentless kidney stones. Help!
Okay.
Yeah.
Whenever you say that, I sometimes think, like, do you really, Layla? It's a question.
No.
It's a question.
Knockwood. Yeah.
All right. So we'll return and field more questions. Radioprogram@AOL.com, the destination for questions. And we'll be right back with more of this weekly edition of Q&A with Layla. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.